On air, online, on digital radio and television, and on the ABC Listen app. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
There's a wait to get into the abattoir and there's a wait to get onto the boat. So, you know, it's just compounding. My understanding from what we're hearing is that it's now starting to level off at last.
Calls for a regular freight link between King Island and Victoria and a new system of accreditation for wool growers.
Our new scheme says that all wool must use an e-bale, an e-pack, which are relatively new to the industry. All wool growers will use WoolClip, which is a way of digitally capturing the information on farm.
Stay with us for that story in just a tick. We'll also have Richard Bailey on the Livestock Report. Richard Bailey will join us just before 1 o'clock, so make sure you stay with us. And if you'd like to join the conversation, you can text in on 0438 922 936. Now, starting the program today, we're going to talk blueberries and blueberry rust, which is one of those diseases that affects many blueberry growers around the state. Joining me in the studio is Associate Professor Cara Berry from the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Fiona.
Good morning. Now, you had about 30 growers at a field day yesterday, and I suppose that's a really good chance to get together and talk about the latest research, the latest marketing, all that sort of thing.
Yep, it's a good time of year to get growers together because they've sort of finished their harvest, they've sort of just getting their tidying up jobs done, and they've got a little bit of room to breathe to just think about, you know, updates that we can give them on the research we've been doing.
Well, I'm sure consumers out there think we had a good blueberry season because there's been a lot of beautiful blueberries in the supermarkets, pretty cheap often at times as well. Was there any chat around about that sort of thing?
We did have someone from Fruit Growers Tas talking about, I guess, the season, I guess, wrap up in terms of yield and harvest and also exports and so on. But, yeah, in terms of prices, I don't quite know how that's sort of handled day to day. But, yeah, I guess there's a lot of producers now and there's a lot of, you know, consumer demand for fruit. So, yeah, they can move a lot of fruit through and get good prices and, yeah.
Also, lots of different fruit sort of crossing over in seasons, et cetera, which doesn't always help with price. But tell me, you're an expert on blueberry rust. Just how much of a problem is it in Tasmania these days?
So I guess, you know, blueberry rust was really a problem when it came in as a new disease, and therefore it was managed through a containment program as an incursion response. It was deregulated almost 2 years ago now, and so we are now managing that disease. And where it has spread, it certainly does seem to be, you know, manageable, but it's there, and it's that sort of continuous presence that has to be managed, like on top of a lot of the other diseases we already have. But I think a lot of growers still haven't, especially in the south, had any detected on their properties. But if they're exporting to, say, South Australia, they need to manage their fruit as if they do have it. They have to go through certain protocols and use fungicides to reduce the risk that they could introduce it into areas that don't have it.
So what does it look like? How does it present in a blueberry bush?
Yep. So it's, I guess, most noticeable on the leaves, on the foliage, because that's, you know, there most of the year. So you'll see little red spots on the tops of the leaves. And then if that infection has developed, you turn the leaf over and you might see some golden coloured spores. So a golden kind of powdery grouping on the other side of the leaf. Yeah.
So it's obviously detrimental to the plant. Does it affect fruiting and that sort of thing?
Yep, so it can slow the whole plant down. So when you have quite a heavy infection, it definitely slows down the plant in terms of production, and it can cause lesions on the fruit as well, which is going to be an instant sort of downgrade of that fruit. Yep.
So you'd want anyone, even if it's a backyard blueberry grower, to just keep an eye out for that sort of thing?
I think so. I mean, it certainly was previously reportable. So if someone did see it before, they were very strongly encouraged to report it to Biosecurity Tasmania. It's not reportable anymore. So if someone sees it in their backyard, then you know, there's a few things they can do. They can try and remove infected leaves and, you know, put them in the rubbish. They can use some kind of fungicide spray if they've got some kind of basic copper spray or something like that. Also things like just making sure your plants are kind of well aerated, they're not getting too wet and moist, will hopefully mean the disease doesn't take off too much. Yeah.
And is this something that's pretty much right around Australia now, all those blueberry growing states?
Yep. So it's in every state that grows blueberry apart from South Australia.
That's why they don't want... Are we sending fruit there? Are you,
we do, yeah. Yep. Quite a few of our growers export fruit to South Australia, and they have to meet a sort of a trade protocol for that reason. And previously we had to do the same thing for Western Australia and Victoria, but they now have had the disease detected there as well. So it possibly won't be too long. It may be that South Australia will eventually get it as well, and then there'll be no trade agreement to sort of follow for that interstate movement of fruit anyway.
Yeah. Well, Associate Professor Cara Barry, tell me, where are you at with your research? Because you've got a small team that works on this?
Yeah, we do. So we have, we've had two projects now funded by the state government, and the project we've started about a year ago now is focusing particularly on trying to understand how the disease survives over winter, because we are probably one of the coldest regions it's been detected in, and we'd like to know if it survives over winter on living foliage, what are the options we have to sort of deal with that? So it could be defoliation, so removal of leaves so that there's no living leaf material for the fungus to survive on. So that's something that we've been doing for the last almost 3 years now. We've been doing defoliation trials. And our aim there is to work with either evergreen or semi-evergreen varieties and see what happens if we remove the leaves sort of in late autumn with a chemical defoliant, and then see if that has an impact on yield. And if it doesn't have any impact on yield, then it's potentially a useful tool.
The way to go.
As sort of an alternative to fungicides, yeah.
So now it's late autumn pretty much, isn't it?
Yep. So we're about to, we've just started our third year of trials, and we have narrowed down to a synthetic abscisic acid product that we're trialling. And we're working with a blueberry cultivar called Legacy, which is one that does keep growing quite a lot through winter. And last year we tried urea, we tried a copper sulfate product, and while they were successful at removing the leaves, they also quite damaged the flower and fruit buds. So we ended up getting a big reduction in yield, which is not
viable.
We don't
want that.
No.
Yeah. All right. So, I mean, blueberries are a very important crop for Tasmania, and I believe the crop numbers, the tonnages are keep growing at this point. So your research is funded by the state government. Is there any other funding or backing of research for you, for your Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture team out there?
For blueberry rust, not at the moment. However, it is a growing sort of national issue now. And so I think that sort of better management issues is something that the sort of National Blueberry Growers Association may be interested to fund more of, because it has been quite a bad season for it. Certainly in New South Wales, there's been a lot of rust there, and you know, there's different growing environments too, like growing in tunnels. It quite reduces, I guess it just changes the environment, and it means that, you know, you may or may not use the same fungicides or same products or have the same options.
Different environments.
Yeah, so there's different environments which it might be good to learn a bit more about sort of optimal management.
Yep. Okay. Associate Professor Cara Barry from the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture, thanks so much for joining us on The Country Hour.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If healthy living is your thing, the ABC Listen app has all the podcasts. Try the Health Report.
These are ultra-processed products, and if you compare the calories,
you might also like What's That Rash?
You're talking about zits.
Teenagers love to go...
Or Life Matters.
Love online after 50. It took me 18 months to download my first dating app.
Get your health kicks anywhere, anytime with the ABC Listen app.
It's the Country Hour with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
King Island farmers are calling out for more reliable and competitive shipping service amid a serious backlog of animals. The island produces more than a fifth of Tasmania's beef on grass that normally grows 12 months of the year. But amid the driest conditions in 100 years, farmers are moving off extra stock because they can't feed them. TasFarmers Chairman Ian Saw told Meg Powell the shipping needs to change.
It's a bit of a schmozzle, Meg. There's just not enough frequency. There's not enough coordination with shipping. So there's the Tasports boat is doing mainly livestock for Greenham. The other boat's doing general cargo. The problem that Tas farmers are finding out, and we've actually employed a drought coordinator on there this week, is the lack of coordination, which is making things difficult. So no one knows whether the boats are half full or full to get general freight or livestock off the island. But in essence, the main issue is getting livestock off and feed on. That's the most important thing. And there's very little feed in Tasmania to bring to the island. The bulk of the feed that we could get is on the mainland in Victoria because they've been having good seasons. But there are no boats or very few boats that go north.
So boats mostly from King Island go to Tasmania and then to Victoria.
Yep. 85% of their trade is to Tasmania. There is the Bass Strait shipping out of Bridport. They've been carting livestock out of King Island to the mainland, Port Welshpool, I think, and they've been doing that for two or three farmers on King Island. But there's no solid continuity of a boat or boats going north.
And at the moment, our abattoirs in Tasmania are quite full, from what I understand. So if a farmer decides, I need to get rid of 200 cattle because I can't feed them in all of a sudden, where can they take them?
Well, Tasmania. That's the problem. That's the problem. And so, you know, there's a wait to get into the abattoirs and there's a wait to get onto the boat. So, you know, it's just compounding. My understanding from what we're hearing is that is now starting to level off at last. But there's still a wait. I mean, the abattoirs are full, so you're going to have a two-week wait for there, and you might have a two-week wait to get cattle onto the boat. So there's not a lot of flexibility, which is really annoying when you've got, you know, the driest time in 100 years on King Island. There seems to be very, very little flexibility in the port's operations and the boat's operations. It sort of beggars belief a little bit, but that's what we're dealing with, and I think that what really needs to happen in the longer term is that we need to get some competition with shipping into that route and get some shipping going to the mainland as well.
The Tasmanian government promised an extra sailing per week recently to help alleviate the drought, the impacts of the drought. Where's that going, and is that helping?
Yep, they actually got it sailing over Easter, which was extraordinary, and they have increased the sailing over the last few weeks, which is good, but they're still trying to catch up with the backlog. So the more sailings, the better.
What needs to happen? I guess it's an emergency time at the moment, but sounds like it's not ideal even at the best of times.
There just needs to be some competition in the port itself. There needs to be some competition with another boat there going. What I'm hearing is that we need to make sure that there's consistent and continuity with boats going to Tasmania to cart livestock there. A lot of farmers are saying it would be absolutely terrific to get livestock to Melbourne. If you go directly north to Port Otway, there's two or three abattoirs within 2.5 hours there. So, you know, it would open up a completely new market for King Island. But that's all something for the King Islanders to work out. But you're absolutely right. These are extraordinary times. Worst drought in 100 years on King Island. And we should be pulling out all stops to try and help, not just do business business as usual.
And that was Tasfarmers Ian Saw there explaining the shipping situation on King Island, which hasn't had a regular direct service to the mainland since early 2022. And if you want to find out more about that, have a look at the ABC Tasmania online page and you'll see a story there by Meg Powell and Kath Sullivan. Now, New South Wales authorities are investigating the discovery of hundreds of butchered horses at an alleged illegal knackery in the state south. But the case has raised more questions than answers. Wagga Wagga City Council said it was leading the investigation with New South Wales Police and other agencies after reports horse carcasses had been dumped around a dry creek bed near the town. It said more than 500 horses appeared to have been slaughtered over a long period of time. Reporter Lucas Forbes spoke to Adrian Talbot, the man at the centre of the allegations. Here's what he had to say.
A number of authorities come onto the premises, EPA, RSPCA, Rural Crime Squad, BioSafe, Council, all inspected the property.
They allege that there were that it's an illegal knackery.
Yeah.
Can you just tell me how many horses, how many horse bodies are on your property?
Yeah. And so they came out. They came out to inspect, alleged 30 or 40, which would be closer to the number for Bill Thompson to say 500. It was blown way out of proportion, way way out.
Why are these horses here?
Yeah,
because
look, I've been buying horses 20 years. And when horse sales are on, I take horses to different horse sales. People bring a lot of horses to home as far as, you know, especially like on the racing side of things. Like I've been placed on an excluded list because there's nowhere for people, for owners, strappers, trainers to send their thoroughbreds. There's that many rules and regulations in place. They just can't do anything with them. There's paddock fulls of them sitting around everywhere, getting neglected because they can't. There's nowhere for them to go.
So how did these horses die?
So they were euthanized humanely by a licensed shooter for my own purpose or my own pet food. I become involved in the Brumby side of things. So rules and regulations with the Brumbies through the national parks is that their guidelines, you need a slam shut gate, take a minimum of 5 horses, has to be 1800 high. Not everyone has the means of transport for a wild horse, and not everyone wants to take 5 horses at once. So I drive up there, take the truck up with the facilities at home. I can load 1 horse, I can load 2 horses, I can load 10 horses. So people would come, phone up and take horses, or I'd deliver them.
I mean, were any of those horses, these Brumbies, were they among the ones that were euthanized?
There was which national parks are well aware of, because you have to state where they go and what the destination of them is. There was a handful of older horses. There was one that had one eye that needed veterinary attention that they probably shouldn't have been sent down either.
Cara Jeffrey has been following the story and she spoke to our New South Wales Country Hour presenter, Michael Condon.
We conducted a review of Sustainable.
Well, this is where the discrepancies, I guess, come in between Adrian Talbot and the authority that's been investigating at Wagga Wagga City Council. Wagga Wagga City Council are still standing by their original claims that there were 500 horses, while Adrian Talbot told the ABC, as you've heard, 30 to 40 horses. So it is still no clearer, except that Wagga Wagga City Council are standing by what they're claiming and Adrian Talbot is standing by his figures. So, you know, there is a huge discrepancy. Where are these 460 other horse carcasses?
Mm. Has anyone actually been out and had a look at the property?
So a reporter from our office here at ABC Riverina did venture to the outside of the property yesterday. It's my understanding that he spoke with Mr. Talbot at the property, so it can confirm that it is his property. No horses, carcasses were sighted. Live horses were sighted in the paddock, but no carcasses or anything has been confirmed by the ABC at the property.
And he wasn't able to get out to that dry creek bed.
No, and that is also, there's also been some discrepancies in the dry creek bed. In the interview that we heard from Adrian Talbot, that he said it wasn't a creek bed as much on his property where council is saying it was, and about, yeah, there has also been some discrepancies in the creek bed.
It sounds like there's a bit of confusion there, but Snowy Mountains Brumby Group President Diane Hardley told the ABC she wants a full investigation.
Well, it's not surprising. It's been a well-known fact right throughout the Brumby community and Wagga for a long, long time. It was brought to our attention a couple of years ago. On the 4th of July last year, we sent an email to Atticus Fleming, the head of National Parks, and the RSPCA with welfare concerns over a registered rehomer where these 500 horses have been found. And once again, no action, no investigation.
Was there any response from National Parks?
No, no response whatsoever. I showed you a copy of the email today and there was no response whatsoever. The numbers of horses staggered me. The thing that upset me too was the fact that some of those carcasses were recent and, you know, rehoming is still part of the management plan. We've been waiting for horses, for a load of horses, and have been told twice this week they don't have any. If he got 500 horses through National Parks, where's the paperwork? Where's the paperwork? Like we didn't get any paperwork? Because when you get horses from National Parks through Blowing, you get paperwork. This needs a full investigation by National Parks, Penny Sharp, and everything should halt until that's done.
Diane Hardley ending that report, and you can read more about that story on the ABC Rural online page. Now, Australian wool producers will soon be able to sign up to a revamped scheme to set certified sustainable wool standards. The Australian Wool Sustainability Scheme was officially launched at the International Wool Textile Organisation Congress in Adelaide. The scheme is managed by the Australian Wool Exchange, which hopes it'll boost the international reputation of wool by setting new standards for production and sourcing.
We conducted a review of Sustainable, the integrity scheme, and that was about 15 months ago. And so within that, there were recommendations that came forward, but also an opportunity for us to reset and relaunch what is now the new scheme, which is now called the Australian Wool Sustainability Scheme. And the support we've received and recognition we've received has been great.
So what was the need, I guess, to essentially evolve the old scheme into what this new one is? And we'll talk about what changes in a moment. But why was there a need to evolve how it had been working?
Well, like with any scheme and with any business, you need to be in constant contact with your customers and find out what their needs are. And we realised clearly that there was an opportunity for us and a need for us to actually revisit what the principles were and also what the scheme was going to deliver.
The new scheme, what do wool growers need to do to be accredited? How does it work?
Well, the aim here is to use a digital solution to create absolute transparency but also efficiency for not only the grower, but also for the broker, the buyer, and their customers overseas. Previously, it was a mixture of digital and paper-based. We're trying to reduce the, I suppose, inconvenience in many respects of audit, which is a common term used these days, is audit fatigue, because similar companies are running down the same driveway and doing the same things, and quite frankly, growers are getting tired of that. And we wanted to make sure that we had the opportunity to certify a product very quickly without the complication of infrastructure that has been in existence beforehand.
So with the standards that have been set under this new scheme, I understand there's four pillars to this.
There is four pillars to it, and they are the same pillars or similar pillars to what we had with Sustainable. But what we're doing is using a digital opportunity to actually measure them. So, and transfer that information. So, for instance, our new scheme says that all wool must use an e-bale, an e-pack, which are relatively new to the industry. All wool growers will use wool clip, which is a way of digitally capturing the information on farm, which really is the source of truth, and that will transfer that information through the supply chain. And the introduction of using pain relief or analgesia for any husbandry practice, including tail docking castration. So there's some of the measures that are significantly different, but also give a greater level of confidence to our buyers about the practices and sustainability claims that are being made on farm.
So I understand there's two pathways to accreditation, and you mentioned there about the control of fly strike and how that's done. So two pathways, sustainable and responsible. One allows Muesling for yep. fly strike control. Why split it like that?
Well, one thing is very important here, that Sustainable was built originally on a non-mules accreditation scheme. It morphed, if you like, or evolved into including mules with pain relief. What we're saying here is that the Sustainable brand will still exist for those that seek the sustainability credentials, not just about animal husbandry, because that's not the key focus here. It's about accreditation that they have for claims for their environment, for the people, the community in which they work. So the Sustainable will still hold true to that. Responsible, where the only difference really is the treatment of mulesing, where it has to be done with pain relief, whether it be analgesic or anaesthetic. And it's important that this scheme, because it's an Australian-based scheme, recognises the landscape and environment that Australian wool is grown. We're a big country, and we vary from literally the drought to flooding plains. And it's important that we can recognise the sustainability credentials of wool growers who grow wool in any capacity, provided they meet the requirements of the scheme itself.
And that was the Australian Wool Exchange's CEO, Mark Grave, speaking with Selena Green. Time now for the news headlines with Laura Beavis.
Thanks, Fiona. In ABC News, a teenage boy charged with a terrorism offence after allegedly stabbing a bishop during a live-streamed sermon will remain in custody. The 16-year-old is under police guard in hospital. His lawyer did not apply for bail during a brief court hearing, and the case was adjourned until mid-June. A security guard stabbed at Westfield Bondi Shopping Centre has been granted a permanent resident visa. Mohammed Taha was wounded on Saturday while trying to help his colleague, who was one of six people murdered. A number of harness racing participants, including trainer Ben Yole, have been issued bans from Tasmanian racetracks. Last week, a Supreme Court decision granted Tas Racing the power to issue the warning off notices as a response to the Ray Murray report, which named the four participants. And millions of Indians have started voting in a six-week election, which is seen as a referendum on Prime Minister Narendra Modi. If he wins, he'll be only the second Indian leader to remain in power for a third term. And there'll be more news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Laura. Time to cross to the Weather Bureau now. And good afternoon, Ellie Matthews. Can you tell me, was there much rainfall overnight?
Well, we did have a cold front that passed over the state yesterday, which did bring showers to most parts of the state. The bulk of the rainfall did fall through the west, but there were some isolated parts of the southeast and east coast that did get up to 7 millimetres. Generally through the Midlands, readings varied up to 5 millimetres, and whilst most of the north and northwest missed out on a lot of this rainfall activity, much of the rain really fell through the western tiers there.
All right. What's the outlook?
Well, in terms of rainfall, with a ridge of high pressure pushing over the state, things are looking dry. So tomorrow it'll start off quite clear and cool. There'll be some patchy fog, but it will otherwise remain quite dry across the weekend as we've got a very slow-moving high progressing from the Bight and over Victoria. It will eventually have some westerly winds build up through Sunday, which will push showers into the west, but otherwise throughout central, northern and eastern parts it'll remain dry. Monday we could see some possible afternoon showers pushing into the north and northeast. That's with a bit of an onshore flow through there, Fiona.
Any warnings at all?
For tomorrow we have a strong wind warning for southern coastal waters from Tasman Island to Low Rocky Point.
And coastal waters and swell?
Yeah, so at the moment we've got a south to southeasterly winds, 15 to 25 knots, which are starting to tend more west to southwesterly, 10 to 20 knots at the moment. And into tomorrow, we're looking more at a northwest to southwesterly winds, 15 to 25 knots, reaching up to 30 knots about the south, and winds are tending quite variable about the east tomorrow. The swells at the moment today, we've got a southwesterly in the west and south of 3.5 to 4.5 metres with the significant wave height at Cape Sorrel sitting at 4 metres. In the north, we've got a westerly to 1 metre. That also continues into tomorrow. And through the east, we've got a southerly of 1 to 2 metres, tending southwesterly to 2.5 metres offshore in the south. And that continues through until tomorrow there, Fiona.
Okay, Ellie Matthews, thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
If you were to charter a course for Antarctica, you might stop for a wee and a walk at the halfway point.
Afternoons.
Which is Macquarie Island.
With Joel Reinberger.
It's the Campbelltown of the Southern Ocean. Ranger Paul Black, how much marine debris do you pick up?
Pick up quite a bit. We've just got a hailstorm coming through. It's all the Gen 2 penguins outside getting a bit upset, and now they're racing towards me. They're not enjoying that hail, that's for sure.
Joel Reinberger. Weekdays from 1:30, ABC Radio Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour. You're with Fiona Breen on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Researchers who've spent decades coming up with a better bio-harvesting method for wool say they're almost to the point of commercial viability. The process will give producers an alternative to traditional shearing by creating a weak point in the wool fibre, allowing for mechanical harvesting. So how soon could it be ready for use and how much will it cost? University of Adelaide Professor Phil Hind has been heading up the research.
We've been researching the idea of bioharvesting for about 15 to 20 years now, and we've made some progress along the way, but just recently, in the last 2 years, we made a very significant breakthrough, which has made it, you know, potentially commercially viable now.
So what is this breakthrough? Has this been in the administration or the efficacy of this method?
Yeah, mainly what it was we've identified a target. It's kind of a biochemical target that operates in the follicle, which produces the fibre, the wool fibre. And once we identified that target, which if you hit the target with the right bullet, it makes the wool weak, which means, it doesn't harden properly. You know, wool and hair starts off soft and squishy like all cells in your body, but a hardening process makes it turn into the dead thing we've got on our head. And that's the process we've worked out, and we've worked out which bullet to use.
What's it taken to get to this point?
A lot of work. apart from that, we had to do a lot of pretty clever science to work out just how we might be able to make wool weak enough that we could break it just by combing, but not so weak that it would fall out in the field, because that would, remove the whole idea. Mm. We want it to be weak enough that we can break it easily with a comb or a combing-type machine, but really sufficiently strong that it won't come off in the paddock. And we proved the whole thing about 2 years ago, so we can make it weak. It stays on the paddock. It protects the sheep from sunburn and cold. And we know we can remove it with simple mechanical devices.
Right, so it's the not too hot, not too cold, the just right method that
Correct.
You've been trying to get to it, and you reckon you've got there.
Yeah, it's the Goldilocks solution. That's right.
So what happens from here now that you've sort of reached this point where, you know, you've got to where you're hoping to be with the method? What happens then next?
So what we have to do is we've got to do a lot of the hard work of getting, it's a naturally occurring chemical, it's a naturally occurring protein we're using. We can extract it from plants, so that's a good thing. It's natural, organic type compound. We've got to get that compound accredited for this use through regulations. So APVMA chemical approval has to be reached. So we've got to do a lot of clinical trials in sheep right across the country. We've got to prove that it works in all sheep types, in all environments, and that it doesn't cause any health problems to the animal.
So quite a few hurdles still to overcome.
Yep.
Realistically, what do you see as a time frame? Can you put a time frame on when this might be something widespread in use out in the paddocks?
Yep, we've got a time frame because everything in this project is so critical. We've got to get this to work because the industry is quite desperate to overcome the shearer shortage. And so we're on a very tight deadline to make sure that we can deliver it. Our aim is to have it ready for on-farm use by the end of 28.
And that was Professor Phil Hind from the University of Adelaide speaking with Selena Green. And we're going to have a little bit of Friday music now, Beautiful to Me by Little Birdie. A nice Friday song by Little Birdie, Beautiful to Me. And now a bit of a snapshot of some rural stories around the nation. And what is, it says, is the first time the Beston Global Food Company has split its payments to its milk suppliers, citing the challenging conditions facing the dairy industry globally. Farmer payments from the company will be staggered this month, 85% of what they're owed initially and the remaining 15% by the end of April. President of the South Australian Dairy Farmers Association, Robert Brokenshire.
It's a tight international market and I think they've been held up with some payments that are due to them from overseas wholesalers, but it is generally speaking rare, and SADA, as the Dairy Farmers Association for our farmers, obviously want our farmers paid on time and in full. So it is going to put some farmers under pressure, and I've discussed that with Bestons, but, you know, Bestons are doing what they can to make sure their business is as strong and sustainable as possible, and obviously whatever business you're in, most are fairly highly geared, and, you know, that's no different with our dairy farmers. So if they've got cash flow plans for their budget for that month, then obviously if they don't get all their money straight away, that does make it tough for them.
And that was President of the South Australian Dairy Farmers Association, Robert Brokenshire. Now, the Senate committee tasked with advising the federal government on invasive fire ant management in Australia is expected to hand down its report soon. It's been estimated that if fire ants aren't eradicated by 2035, they'll cost Australia up to $2.5 billion. Rod Campbell from the independent think tank group, the Australia Institute, believes government commission modelling has downplayed the risk by only assessing a 15-year timeframe.
Their study, I think, puts a reasonable estimate on the cost in 2035 at $2.5 billion worth of damage in that year. The problem is that their analysis then cuts out and says, oh, hang on, no more after that. Whereas in reality, Australians will still be living with fire ants after, unless we do something about it, after 2035, we'll still be living with fire ants and we'll still be enduring damages of at least $2.5 billion per year. And it's to avoid those damages is why we should be investing in fire ant eradication now. The key point is that it's worth it for Australians to invest in eradicating fire ants now rather than waiting and enduring the costs later. It's worth spending $300 million a year for 10 years now to avoid decades of costs equal to at least $2.5 billion per year.
And sticking with pests, it's estimated that ticks are the most serious external parasite for cattle in Australia. In fact, it costs the industry more than $160 million a year, according to Meat and Livestock Australia. Researchers are now asking for farmers to fill out a questionnaire and collect samples of ticks found on farm. It could help scientists develop a vaccine to prevent deaths from tick fever, which affects cattle in northern Australia. Researchers from the University of Melbourne want to hear from farmers from across the country.
We've heard devastating stories about ticks and tick-borne diseases from them. While farmers in New South Wales and Victoria are complaining of tick paralysis caused by the paralysis tick and bovine filariosis, which is transmitted by bush tick, others in Queensland and other states are burdened with tick fever. And the death of cattle and calves range from 1 to 50, given that there are variations from one property to another. However, there are more deaths recorded due to bovine filariosis as compared to tick fever. Most probably because while there is a vaccine for tick fever, there isn't any treatment for bovine filariosis.
And that was Zainab Umar, vet science PhD researcher at the University of Melbourne. So contact the University of Melbourne Vet Science Department if you want to be involved in that.
Hi, Sabra Lane here. Here's a news flash. Not all the news is negative. Seriously. There are stories of progress, hope, and how individuals and groups are making the world and our communities a better place. And those stories can be inspiring. You can hear some of those ideas on the ABC's new podcast, The Bright Side. Search for The Bright Side podcast in the ABC Listen app or listen to the broadcast Saturday morning from 8 on ABC Radio Hobart.
Keeping you updated every day. The Tasmanian Country Hour with Fiona Breen.
Now, here's a happy horse story. In an age of urbanisation and big diesel motors, a career path that perhaps flies under the average Australian's radar is that of an outback horse trainer. On cattle stations across Australia's north, Hamish Lamond breaks and trains horses, but he often finds that humans walk away with a bigger lesson. Alice Marshall saddled up with him to find out more.
Motorbikes and helicopters are pretty common sights on outback cattle stations, but Hamish Lamond is keen on making sure that horses stay in the mustering mix too.
I grew up east of Perth in a little town called York, and we'd always had horses around as kids, and I've always just loved being around horses and loved being able to get on a horse and go and explore a bit of bush behind home. So I suppose that's where the love for horses came. Yeah, I'd always loved horses, and then I suppose through high school I stopped riding as much, and then when I left school, I had photography as my first preference to go to uni, but my parents said it would probably be a good idea to take a gap year, and I ended up going to Ruby Plains Station out of Halls Creek. And I can remember the day, I can even remember where we were, and we were just sitting, I was sitting on a horse blocking up some cattle, and I was like, this is pretty cool, I'm getting paid to sit on a horse and do what I love.
These days, Hamish is a horse breaker and trainer, and a bit of a human trainer too.
Yeah, this time of the year I'll spend the majority of my time going from station to station, especially before they start getting into mustering, and just help put a bit of a foundation for the year around how they're going to handle and work their horses. I genuinely just love horses and love being on their back and love being able to work and influence staff and hopefully help instill some great values in the industry and leave each place in a little bit better place if it's not the people, the horses or the cattle, which is, yeah, pretty cool. There's definitely different characteristics and traits in all different horses, which keeps me sort of adapting and changing what I do with horses. It's and they'll all sort of take different things at a different pace. So yeah, all horses are different in a sense, but I think it all does come back to one general idea of how they operate, and with how I work them. I'm always learning new things and I'm always changing, which is pretty cool. I'm definitely not stuck in a way and say that this suits every single horse that I come across. So I'm lucky enough to have some great people in my life that I call mentors, and if I come across a bit of a tricky horse, I'll speak to them and try things a bit of a different way. Probably two values that I really hold in a high regard is compassion and empathy, and I feel working with horses to get the best out of them, that has to be high up in your list. So I just try and think of everything from the horse's perspective, relate everything I do back to how horses used to live and what makes horses tick.
And that was Hamish Lamond there. And you can read more of that story by Alice Marshall if you head online over the weekend. Just pop ABC Rural and Horse Trainer in your search engine. Time now for the Livestock Report with Richard Bailey. Good afternoon.
Hello, Fiona. How are you?
Very good, thank you. Now tell me, how was Piranha?
Well, we had 4,243 cattle at Piranha yesterday. Now, for Tassie, that's a big sale. That sort of takes you back to the old Bothwell days. That's twice this year, I think, we've had over 4,000 cattle in our weaner sale. So that was always going to test the market a little bit. There was a really good lineup of cattle. The better steers certainly were attached dearer than a fortnight ago, and I think generally speaking we're sort of fully firm anyway. Unfortunately the heifers were a bit cheaper, about 40% went out, and some of them went as high up as Gundawindi, which is a fair trip on those. Some went into East Gippsland, northern New South Wales, and northern Victoria, and western Victoria. So they're all over.
Wow.
And obviously we had good local support as well. Just very quickly, heavy winter steers, $880 to $1,200 to average 3.15 a kilo. Medium weights, $820 to $1,060 to average 3.15. Light, $500 to $900 a head to average 3.10. And very small, $250 to $650 a head to average 2.75. Over in the heifers, the best of the heifers made $540 to $800, $800, $2.10. Medium weights, $460 to $700, $2.00. And light, $390 to $600, $2.00. Very small, $140 to $400 a head, $165. That's probably the cheapest of the heifers we've seen this year. That would be well below the cost of production, I guarantee that.
Okay. What about sheep and lamb at the moment?
It's been a pretty interesting week sheep-wise. I think it's been well documented that with this business in the Middle East, that all of a sudden that Middle East trade has stopped dead or almost stopped dead. It's meant that basically no buyers were in the markets for those light MK lambs. And that knocked them around pretty savagely. In some markets, particularly early in the week, Bendigo and Ballarat, those lambs were $40 cheaper, so that wasn't good news. The general trend during the week's been, though, that trade in heavy lambs have been pretty good. And yesterday, sort of at Wagga, $620 to $660 a kilo. There were good trade lambs that did make $700, but in that sort of $620 to $660 a kilo. And then you got into those secondary lambs and they were very quickly down to $500 a kilo. Over in the mutton yard, that's been a bit of a downward trend now for a couple of weeks, and it didn't change this week. I'm assuming that quite a few of these mutton are probably destined for the Middle East and so have copped the same sort of treatment as those lambs did. A lot of mutton, $200 to $270, but more in the $200 to $250 a kilo. You might remember last week that we were talking about buyers trying to keep the price under $300. Well, they've certainly done that all right.
All right, Richard Bailey, thank you very much. We'll catch you again on Wednesday.
Good on you, Fiona.
Time now to chat to Joel Reinberger. Good afternoon, Joel.
Hello, Fiona. What is your favourite flower, Fiona?
Oh, my favourite flower. I like a tiger lily. You know, the orange ones.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very nice. They're very pretty. Personally, it's what's right outside our window here at the ABC, which is Daphne.
Ah,
And I mean, A, it is the sweetest smell in nature. I just adore the smell of Daphne. And B, they come out when there's no other flowers.
Yes.
There's just like nothing. It's the desert
in
for
winter.
Flowers in the midwinter. They come out kind of late winter. So I love Daphne for all those reasons. We've got a very floral show today,
lovely.
Is why I'm asking you.
What are we doing?
So a bunch of stuff. Now, it turns out Government House has put an ad out looking for a new part-time florist.
Oh,
so they have a florist
a nice
already.
Job.
Yeah. The florist does not get to order any flowers. The florist just uses what they grow.
Do
now,
they get to have lunch at Government House? And
I presume so. That's where they are. You have to leave.
Like
go and eat your KFC by the door.
I mean, you know, from the chefs, I'd go for that.
Look, I reckon they probably would. I reckon there'd be a staff lunch on there and it'd be pretty spectacular. Hello to Ainsley, the head chef there.
Yes.
but she just uses what's grown in the garden, and I think she gets some input into what they grow in the garden as well. So yeah, it's just
that
each
would
week.
Be a nice job. I'd like that.
And fascinating job, you know, making the things you've got work as bunches, as posies, in vases, on little plates, whatever else you need to do. So we're going to talk about what that job is of being a florist. We're also going to talk to Hannah Maloney from Gardening Australia about the project she's been doing, the Flower Power Project.
Oh, the flower one. I've seen that on social media. That looks like fun.
Yeah, so basically they're growing flowers in various places and then, you know, each week they take nominations, who deserves flowers, and turn up to give people beautiful bunches of Hannah's homegrown flowers, which is a gorgeous thing. So we'll find out how that's been going, because I think going into the winter, there ain't that many flowers around anymore, so they'll probably need to have a break.
Except maybe Daphne.
Yes, later in the winter, there will be Daphne, but I get all of those. And we're also going to talk to a florist about how you kind of make a beautiful posy or a beautiful bunch of flowers, like an how you arrange them so they work, so
it
looks good.
It's not easy, and some people seem to have that knack.
Yeah, they just throw things in a vase and they look beautiful and they've sized them right. We'll also find out about how you actually keep them living longer.
Okay.
Because
a bit of sugar or something?
I've heard that. I used to put lemonade in with the water. Like that's what I was told. You know, essentially it's lemon juice and sugar. So a harmless kind of combination. So a very flower today. And musically, with our music review, we're looking at remixes. So you take the parts of an original song and you remake it for a new audience. So we'll
remember when they used to do, they might still do mashups?
Yes. Add two songs together. No. Remix. Remake the song as Pendulum did for the ABC News theme some years ago. Or you might remember the Elvis song, A Little Less Conversation, was remade for a new audience a few years ago. Kind of pepped it up, made it a club song.
Okay, Joel Reinberger, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I'll catch you again on Monday at noon.